Welcome to Money Talks. My name is Mike Campbell. As I continue to say, I'm glad you're with me, but it's especially after a week like this. And of course, I have good reason to say that because whether it's recognized or not, we're living in a period of historic change, a monetary crisis, all-out attack on the purchasing power of our dollars, all within the context of a sovereign debt crisis. And all of that's becoming more obvious now, and there is more to come. Although I got to tell you, I laugh at my desperation to make people understand there's going to be some serious roadkill here. Well, I guess already some of us are feeling that. And let's be clear, the same people who caused the problem with their policies are sure as heck not going to be the ones getting us out of it. You know, I always say we're in a track record business, and the track record on Money Talks has been spectacular. I mean, we clearly warned people to lock in their mortgage and other borrowing in the summer of 2020. We repeatedly warned people to stay out of government bonds. In the bond market in general. And those who didn't heed that advice are getting killed right now, and there's no way out, which in turn fosters more financial instability, by the way, including in the pension system. Our theme has been to buy commodities as protection against the declining purchasing power of the paper dollars. And as Tony Greer told us last week, maybe now's a time just to hold back if you're looking to take initial positions or add to yours. Not quite yet, but the theme is still intact. You know, in the fall of 2020, we were on top of both the food and fertilizer story. We were telling anyone who'd listen to consider oil and natural gas. But one of the things I'm happiest about when it comes to Money Talks is we feature absolutely some of the top people in the analytical world. And man, are we continuing that trend with Greg Weldon. I always call Greg the analyst that other analysts read because of his broad perspective and thorough research, as well as his track record. I mean, tons of great calls over the last 30 years. But I'm going to give you just one example, because Greg called the tech crash in 2000, which is why I want his perspective on today's tech decline. He told the Money Talks audience about the coming rate increases, well, actually sharp rate increases. He's the author of the Gold Mining Bootcamp, which is why I want to get his take on gold and silver. And there's a lot of other things. I'm also going to talk to Ozzie Jurek about the short-term decline in real estate, which he called in February. But I also want to get his long-term perspective, because think about this. We've had mortgage rates that are several times higher than what we're seeing today, and yet the real estate market recovered and actually moved higher. And my quote of the week is from a big-time investor in the renewable energy and battery storage business. Maybe I should add a warning, by the way, because if you're on board with the transition to renewable energy, you better sit down when you hear it. Because for some people, his bottom line is going to take, well, it's going to be too much to take, actually. Certainly will be for people who think that politics trumps reality, because it doesn't. But first, earlier this week, I posted on Twitter and Facebook, and I want to make sure you get it, because I think it's essential to understand that there's been a sea change in our lives financially. The era of low energy costs or cheap energy, the era of low money costs, cheap money, has come to an end. If you get nothing else from listening to Money Talks, I urge you to consider to understand that the two most important economic and financial variables have changed. Now, I also get that when you start talking like the economy or the financial system, a lot of people tune out. Makes no impact. But I bet when our mortgage payments go up hundreds of dollars, or when a fill-up at the gas pump costs you $50 or $60 or $70 more this year than it did last year, it gets people's attention. We've all noticed the higher grocery prices, but I don't know how many of us really appreciate that higher natural gas and diesel prices are the key driver. Why? Because higher natural gas results in higher fertilizer costs. And of course, our anti-fossil fuel war has created a refinery problem and some supply problem, presto, record high diesel prices. But you know what? I want you to understand that both of which are the result of the war on fossil fuels led by politicians, climate activists, and some members of the media and academic community that is driven by ideology, not common sense. Hey, by the way, can you imagine if they printed this headline? Climate activists push for starvation in emerging markets. Well, that's accurate given their policies have led directly to those rising natural gas prices, and that's rising ammonia and urea. That's fertilizer. 100% last year, by the way, hundreds of percent. Then, of course, you added on the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which just exacerbated the supply chain issues. But what keeps me up at night is that I worry that the next domino to fall is going to be the next leg of the sovereign debt crisis. It's going to move beyond emerging markets into existing markets. And the result? Boy, watch those interest rates. And just remember, central banks don't control interest rates. No. All they can do is really buy government bonds to keep the rates down. But what happens if there's an avalanche of selling from people? Maybe they're worried about inflation or confidence in government, credit problems. But I got a feeling that people could be shocked at how high interest rates could actually go if confidence starts leaving the particular country they're invested in or the system as a whole. That obviously scared the European central banks this week. Why? They held an emergency meeting to discuss new tools, how to handle the sharp rise in interest rates they already have in Italy, Spain, Greece. My bet they won't be successful. Or Japan, my goodness, did that ever get my attention this week as I saw a remarkable, are you ready? 80% rise in interest yields on their 10-year government of Japan bonds. 80% in a single day. These aren't signs of a healthy financial system and credit markets. Neither is a sharp decline, though, in stocks and cryptos. The asset bubble in stocks, housing, art, collectibles, a direct result of central banks manipulating interest rates to record lows, but at the same time, the government's flooded the system indiscriminately with money. And now that process is reversing. You know what? My point, we've entered a new world, and you've got to adjust accordingly. That's why I'm pleased to talk with Greg Weldon today. I got Victor Dare coming up. We've got just so much about this situation that you absolutely cannot ignore it. Your financial health, well, I just think your financial health completely depends upon it. Hey, one other thing this week is, as you know, we have the Special Olympics golf tournament coming up. So I said, I'm going to christen this week's show as the show about the Special Olympics auction. Why? It's the only time I'm doing it to raise money for Special Olympics. But you can bid starting today, which I think is kind of important. You could bid starting today. And there's just so many great things. And I'm going to talk about it throughout the show, but I'll tell you right now. You can go on www.sobcclassic.com. You can do it right now. And the auction closes on Tuesday, the 21st. So right now, and you can go and bid on a ton of stuff. And here's my hope. If you're going to go out for dinner, hey, go ahead. Why not book and bid on one of these things where you can go out for dinner? I love the idea of going away for a couple of days, you know, a nice break. West Coast Wilderness Lodge, spectacular place. Luna Vista Cabins on Quadra Island, great stuff. There's lots of golf. You can play at True North Golf Club or you can play at Morgan Creek. All I'm saying, you're going to buy wine. All I'm saying, if you were going to do that stuff, can you please help us out? We need your help. We do it at Special Olympics. All you have to do is go to SOBC, it's important to get that, classic.com, SOBCclassic.com. It's on right now, finishes on Tuesday. I hope you give us some help. But stay with us. I wait till you hear this quote of the week. I got a goofy award. Everything's coming your way. Well, it's interesting in this kind of a market environment, people feeling, well, nervous may not do it justice, but obviously with the geopolitical events, what's going on in the market, with seemingly with the central bank's determination to lower asset prices, people are looking at gold and saying, what's up with gold? I thought I'd bring in Rob Levy to talk about that. Rob's with, of course, BorderGold.com, follows the market on a momentary basis. Rob, a few things I want to get to. Let me just ask, what about the foot traffic? That's the thing I love to get a chance to chat with you about. You know, are you getting just as many people into Border Gold or fewer or what?
You know, Mike, truth be told, we've calmed down a little bit. The beginning of the year was such a rush into this market that nothing feels like that. And you're almost scratching your head saying, okay, is this the same as it was before? What's going on in this market? But we've had a little bit of a slowdown, but definitely this market action we've seen the past 2 weeks have picked things right up again. There was that perfect storm to start the year, but it's buzzing again because what we're seeing now in the broader markets.
Well, there's a lot of people, though, questioning, you know, they sort of go, and we've said on this show nonstop, it's way too simplistic, but we've got the inflation numbers, of course. We've got geopolitical problems with the invasion of Ukraine and other things, you know, trying to put Taiwan back on the map this week, you know, about their aggressive nature. And they go, well, why isn't gold up another few hundred bucks? Why isn't it 3,000, et cetera? What's your take on that?
A lot of takes, actually. There's a lot of different perspectives and thoughts because I have sort of been racking my brain around this. But you know, the first thing, and I got to say first and foremost, is gold's doing okay. It's stable. You look at what the markets have done year to date, stock markets. You look at other asset classes that have been pummeled. The fact that gold in U.S. dollars is stable year to date, despite inflation, you know, on a year-over-year basis being up over 8%, the fact that gold's holding its own gives me a little comfort because it's doing what it's supposed to do, is stability. But then I say, and we talk about, you just have to look at it in different currencies, and then it's also a different story. So in U.S. dollars, it's stable, but look at it in, say, yen, euro, pounds, Canadian dollars.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's a great point. That's one of the things we always encourage here, is look at an international view. And I mean, if I'm sitting there in Venezuela right now, in Turkey right now, in Japan right now, I'm thinking, look at this fabulous bull market in gold. And even in Canadian dollar terms, I mean, we're much more stable within, because, of course, our exchange rate's been in a fairly small range in the last, I guess, couple of years here. But man, in some of these other currencies, gold's done exactly what they hoped it would be, as be some sort of hedge against currency debasement.
It's exactly right. And it's always been the asset. It's not necessarily negatively correlated, meaning it goes up when the others go down, but it's uncorrelated with your other asset classes. So the fact that stocks have just been absolutely pummeled, and Bitcoin, you know, the disaster, the beginning of what are they calling a crypto winter that's going on in that space, and the parallels that have been made with crypto to gold. Gold's proven that it's still a haven asset, and there's some stability in that asset class, given the year that we've had and the level of inflation. But as you said, I think that's a surprise, and it's a surprise to many of the gold bugs, that gold hasn't risen with inflation expectations. But I think it has to do with the U.S. Fed being out in front and controlling the higher interest rate story.
Well, I was looking at gold. This is going back just about a week, though. It's still the same thing. And looking at the last 2 years in gold, and, you know, you're up about 6% in U.S. dollar terms. I mean, give or take the day we're measuring. But in the last 2 years, you're up 147% in Turkish lira, 84% in the Argentinian peso. So just to reemphasize what we're saying, people may be a little too quick. But of course, the other thing that's now entering into the equation, which is interesting, is that when you get the rise in interest rates, and not just what the Fed's done, but the bond markets reacted much more aggressively, you know, sort of like whatever the Fed's moved, it's doubled that when you look longer term. So finally, that's providing competition, not just for gold, but also for the stocks. But I think it is significant when that starts happening. For some people, they'll go, you know what, I want that guaranteed 3% and a bit percent on my 10-year instead of gold at this point. I'm just saying, whether I agree with that or not, I think that's what's happening.
Hey, I don't disagree with you at all. And that especially as we go into this market environment, and you listen to the commentary yesterday, and that was one of sort of the mainstream Wall Street market calls, is are we nearing the top in long-term interest rates? And maybe that's an asset class. It's not what I'm looking at. It's not what I'm saying, but that's what maybe some of the chatter is around right now. And that's competition for gold, because whenever you have something that's going to pay you a yield, you know, why you're betting on capital appreciation with gold. But definitively, especially in this kind of market environment, and you just have to look across the board where it's just about everything's a loser, except for maybe a few value stocks and some commodity stocks. The stability of gold is what's given me comfort.
And I think that's the point to be made here. Exactly. So if people were looking for a store of wealth, well, clearly at this point, no stock has provided that. I mean, it's sort of the baby out the bathwater in some examples. Certainly government bonds has, and that's always one of the more humorous things for me, is when people say, excuse me, I want something super safe. And I go, well, it isn't in government bonds, I'll tell you. You know, but that's against what the sort of the common theme is. I find it is performing in a way that I think most people would say they wanted it to perform. I mean, you look at it compared to cryptos, by the way, Rob, I got some numbers just yesterday, you know, of the 12,902 cryptocurrencies, 99.8% have fallen at least 70%, you know, and Bitcoin down about 70% plus. So gold, you know, in that tug of war between which one is going to preserve your capital better. Well, I think at least at this stage, I know it's a long game, but at this stage, I think gold's the clear winner.
Yeah, I agree with you, Mike. And leading into our conversation this week, I was remembering what Greg Weldon said at an Outlook conference. I think it was 2019 or 2020, when he was sort of predicting one of these market scenarios when he goes, everything goes down. But his remark was, maybe everything goes down, but gold just goes down by a little less. And it's almost what we've been seeing these last couple of months.
Well, that's a great lead in because we've got Greg coming up next. So I'll chat with him and see where he stands on the whole gold market. In the meantime, Rob, thanks for finding time for us. Great stuff. Bordergold.com, bordergold.com. Rob writes a regular update on the gold market, tells you what's going on from the insider's look, and he'll be doing more of that, of course, in this kind of a marketplace. But Rob, in the meantime, thanks for finding time.
Thanks, Mike. Love to be with you.
Time now for the quote of the week. The chief characteristic of the climate debate has got to be virtue signaling. I mean, no greater measure of that is the fact that pound for pound, Canada talks more about climate change than any other nation on earth. Yet, as Canada's Commissioner of the Environment concludes in his year-end report last December, in quotes, Canada has become the worst performer of all G7 nations since the landmark Paris Agreement on climate change was adopted in 2015. All too often, Canada's environmental commitments are not met with the actions needed, end of quote. You know what's interesting in that? That report came out and there was absolutely no outcry from climate activists, whether they're in the media, academia, or politics. Personally, in broadcasting, I was vilified by some for simply asking that before we spend billions of dollars, we should do a cost-benefit analysis to see if we're actually getting the best bang for the buck. But that's a no-no in the vacuous land of virtue signaling. And even the most basic level, there was no effort to have a practical approach. What we've been doing for the last dozen years is equivalent of running around saying, I'm going to build houses. But someone asks, hey, where are you going to get the materials? And you say, well, I don't have an answer. At the very least, it should be embarrassing. But when there's no accountability, there's also no embarrassment. But that brings me to the quote of the week. It's by Will Van Loo. He's the president and CEO of the private equity firm Quantum Energy Partners. Major investors in utility scale wind and energy storage. Quantum Energy Partners is a global provider. They do the private capital, you know, only to responsibly sourced energy and energy transition and decarbonization sectors. And given climate activists, including in politics, media, and academia, refuse to address the practical concerns of where to produce or obtain the raw resources necessary to actually build wind and solar power and the needed infrastructure. And keep in mind, those estimates, by the way, are 18 times more lithium is needed, 11 times more nickel, double the copper, 17 times more graphite to meet the 2030 green goals. And by the way, you want a new mine to get that stuff? Well, you got to go over the regulatory burden and get it into production, another 7 to 10 years. It doesn't add up, which leads to Mr. Van Loo's quotes. The alternative energy goals for 2030 cannot be met, period. Alternative energy goals are unattainable due to the dramatic need for the world's extractive industries, nickel, silica, copper, graphite, lithium, etc., to expand between 200% and 1,400%. But never before has a global miner's extractive capacity more than doubled in any 10-year period. End of quote. Obviously, the headline there is, the alternative energy goals for 2030 cannot be met, period. That's a heck of a quote, given all of the discussion that we've had about renewable energy. I don't know, you pick the date. Is it 10 years? Is it 20 years? Whatever. Never a practical bone in their body. And this is the end result from someone in the industry who wants to build renewable energy and the battery storage, etc. Alternative energy goals for 2030 cannot be met. It's pretty tough not to be talking interest rates in every aspect of the investment markets. I'll certainly check in with Ozzy about that when we see the huge jump in mortgage rates in the States. But there's another aspect to that mortgage story that I want to get to right now. So I've asked Justin Smith, President Hawkeye Wealth, to talk a little bit about mortgage funds. First of all, Justin, appreciate you taking the time. And what's been the implication for mortgage funds? Just, I know that's a broad brush question, but the implication for mortgage funds in this kind of interest rate scenario that's been happening, say, over the last 3 months?
Yeah, well, as you kind of alluded to, it's you know, maybe a tough time for a lot of borrowers, but it's a great time to be on the lender's side. We still think investing in private mortgage funds is a great option to add defensive positioning and add income to investors' portfolios. That being said, though, Mike, it's important to understand that not all types of mortgage funds are created equal.
Yeah, you absolutely read my mind because, I mean, you know, just because you've got four posted rates, different funds, it doesn't mean that's the one for you. I mean, there must be things that I should be aware of as an individual, you know, as I say, obviously a very legitimate investment, but there still are better ones than others.
Correct. Yeah, funds vary a lot, both in terms of their strategies and level of execution. There are a few things to keep in mind when you're looking at varying funds. The first is the type of assets lent against. What type of real estate is being used as security and where is it located? For example, construction financing and land loans are generally considered higher risk because they're harder to value and they're more difficult to sell should you ever have to foreclose on the property. And also lending in smaller towns is generally considered higher risk than lending in larger cities because it's easier to sell, more liquidity in a larger city if necessary. So you have to be aware of these higher risks and A, make sure it's what you want, and B, if it is, that you're being properly compensated for taking that risk on.
I mean, that makes perfect sense. I mean, obviously, when the tide is coming in hard the way it did, you know, for 2 years pandemic with record low mortgage rates, et cetera, obviously it lifts all boats. But now we come to a period where maybe it's a far more selective market and we get this sort of initial shock. But then it's going to sort of play out to what quality your real estate is. And as you say, liquidity is a big issue here. And obviously, as you say, you'd rather be in large urban centers where there might be a lot more activity than something a little more remote.
Yeah, you got it. Loan to value is another big one as well. Looking at the average loan to value of the portfolio, because the higher the mortgage size or how much you've lent out relative to the value of the property, the higher the risk of a loss for the mortgage holder, as there's just a smaller equity buffer if markets drop. And of course, that's important to a lot of investors, particularly when there's a little bit more uncertainty in the markets. One other important thing for your listeners as well to keep in mind is that there's also substantial transaction costs if you ever had to foreclose on a property. A good rule of thumb is to estimate foreclosure costs, at least in the for residential mortgages, at about 10% of the property value. So, for example, if someone provides an $80,000 mortgage on a $100,000 property, it's easy to assume that property could decrease by $20,000 before the mortgage is underwater. This just simply isn't reality, though. So keep in mind the transaction costs and the loan to value of the fund as it's key when determining how much risk you're taking on.
Yeah, as I say, I'm going to talk more about Aussie about what's going on in the real estate market. But a couple of things that I feel I have to point out is that, you know, in Canada, the level of foreclosure is so low. I mean, you can go back right to the subprime mortgage crisis when it felt like the world came to an end. You still look at the default rates in Canada and they were, I'd call them negligible, well under 1%, didn't matter where you look. So it's traditionally when you've been lending, whether you're a bank or an individual in a mortgage fund, when you've been lending to buyers of real estate, it's been a pretty good, pretty safe investment rather.
Yeah, it's been a really good run. I mean, for the last 10 years, it's been wonderful to be on the equity side, because one thing that mortgage funds don't have is you don't get to take advantage of the upside, right? You're paid the agreed upon interest rate and that's what you get. And for the last, I'm going to say 10 years, people have said, well, 7-8% returns, you know, no, thank you. I'll just go and be on the equity side and hold the real estate, right? And you know what, Mike, I've been talking with you about why people might want to consider mortgage funds as a defensively positioned option for their portfolios for, I don't know, at least a year plus now, isn't it? It's you never know when things are going to change. And, you know, days like today are why we're really pleased that we've been encouraging investors to get into these types of products. Like, the net asset value of the fund that we work with was $1 a year ago, and it's $1 today, and it continues to pay out that income. In fact, the returns, as you were alluding to earlier with the interest rates rising, the returns on many funds are increasing with them. And that's actually another difference between some of these funds. Some funds lend out at fixed rates, and of course, that can be great when rates are dropping and gives you some stability and certainty of income. but they're leaving money on the table as interest rates start to rise, as they're doing right now. So we're grateful the fund we work with is almost exclusively variable rate, which we believe bodes well for returns as the interest rates rise. So it's something to keep in mind as well when you're looking where to invest.
Well, I would think the Bank of Canada, or if you're in the States, Federal Reserve would certainly agree with that. I mean, they can't give any more signs. I mean, it's just so strong, the signals, and we're not done yet, you know, in the rate increase game, sort of. So it's still on the table. But let me just finish with a couple of things here. Tell me what kind, well, of course, this is what you do at Hawkeye Wealth. So you have to select funds. You have to select mortgages, rather, and build a mortgage fund. What kind of rate of return, first of all, just quickly for individuals?
Yeah, I think the good number, at least for the recent past that I've told investors to put in their head, at least for the group that we work with, is a 7%, give or take. I think there's a good chance that those returns will increase here over the short and medium term. It's important, though, that the priority in this is in these deals isn't returns. Not that a 7-8% return is anything to scoff at. The priority is how well defensively positioned these funds are, which is why we chose to work with the group we chose to work with. So you know, for example, when we were looking at funds, we were only looking at funds that had an average loan to value of lower than 60%. Well, when you have an average loan to value of 60%, the markets can drop quite a bit before there's a serious risk of loss of capital on those assets. So really, that's why we like them. Of course, they provide that 7-8% income. You can either have it distributed monthly to your bank account, or you can reinvest that distribution if you want the compounded returns. But primarily, it's about defensive positioning. A lot of our investors, you know, they've worked for many years to get to where they're at on their portfolio sizes. You know, they're entrepreneurs, they're high income professionals. They've worked hard, and really, you know, at some point in your life, your priorities shift, and you're not wanting to be 100% growth anymore. I have a client I was just speaking with who said, you know, Justin, I've got this 200 grand in my holdco. You know, do I really want to go into the mortgage fund, or do I want to wait for a crash and then go into the markets again? And there's not really a right answer to it, except for, you know, there's something to be said for always having some defensively positioned assets in your portfolio that just makes you sleep a little bit better at night. So that's probably the long way to answer your question about returns, Mike, but priority number one is defensive positioning. And then priority two, you know, a 7-8% return while doing so isn't so bad.
Well, I mean, I would think that makes just total sense in this marketplace. I mean, if my comment to begin the show, but my comments, I think, for the last 8 months have been get defensive, be careful, you know, and I don't feel bad about that advice, I'll tell you.
No, it's looking pretty good.
Justin, I don't want to pretend like, you know, we've answered all the questions, but I think you've done a great outline of it. But one of the things that we got your team to do is put out an investor package, a mortgage fund investor package. And people can just go to Money Talks, mikesmoneytalks.ca, mikesmoneytalks.ca. We'll put it there where you can just access it there. But if you've got I think Justin did a great job. If you've got other questions about this, this will certainly handle them. So it's a mortgage fund investor package. Just go to mikesmoneytalks.ca. And Justin, just one more thing before I let you go. Just a reminder, I said this was the Special Olympics auction program today. So I'm not going to stop talking about it, but you guys have supported us in the past. I just want to remind you that the auction runs from now right through until from Saturday right through until Tuesday evening. So go on and help us out. It's sobcclassic.com, sobcclassic.com. But there's so many great things. My thing is, as I said earlier, hey, if you were going to go out for dinner, why not buy the package for Special Olympics? You want wine, why not do that? Especially you want to take one of the weekends, like at the West Coast Wilderness Lodge, personally guarantee it. Just go on there, or the Luna Vista cabins on Quadra Island. These are great things, but you're helping Special Olympics. So Dustin, I expect you to be a winner on some of those. SOBCClassic.com. So much more coming your way. Boy, sometimes it just works out. In this case, works out to have the great Greg Weldon with me today. I mentioned that at the top of the show. And why? Because, you know, he's at the Outlook Conference telling us what was going to unfold in this market. And I think he's just sitting there going check mark, check mark, check mark at this point. But, you know, Greg, it's kind of interesting. I've been watching, well, I take in an inordinate amount of media. And I want to know what people are saying. So I'll watch. I literally do not watch some of the financial news channels. And some of the people are good. The hosts are good, but I don't watch those. I'm not reading them to find out what to do. I'm reading to find out what people are saying. And you know what's been remarkable here is, my goodness, do they ever have a bullish bias? You know, every day it's, what should I buy? Can I buy yet? And I'm thinking, that was my best indicator that we're going a lot lower.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I've gotten a few inquiries this week, like, why are you not on television talking about the stuff you've been, you know, posting in social media, talking about here publicly in Palm Beach County to many, many people, speaking on the radio in a lot of instances, especially on your show, the speeches I've been doing. And it is, it's because everyone has a vested interest, Mike, in the market going up. I mean, you know, when you look at some of the financial networks and the people they have on the shows, and I respect a lot of them, don't get me wrong, I'm not bashing these people per se, but it's the environment, it's the kind of the era, it's the aura even of, you know, you have all these people that are 100% long on stocks talking about why should stocks go up. And guess what? It's almost like there was one point where one of the guys on CNBC said, you know, the long-awaited rally may be here. And that was when we made a low a couple of months ago. And this was in, I believe, actually maybe even, you know, early May, April. And I looked at the chart. It was only 2 months before that we had reached an all-time high. I was like, buddy, man, the market doesn't make an all-time high every 2 months. You know, the market doesn't always go up. And the fact that you're down like 8% from an all-time high doesn't mean, oh, my God, is the correction over? That's what we're going to start asking and focusing on.
Yeah.
But the vested interest is so widespread, so embedded, and frankly, so kind of important to the longer-term health of the economy, if you will. This is the big risk. And this is why the Fed will speak a lot of, you know, kind of misconceptions or even mistruths, to the degree that it's about maintaining confidence than it is telling the truth.
I think that's so right. I mean, maybe the biggest theme I have on Money Talks is I just look for the declining confidence in so many areas. Obviously, it's left emerging markets en masse, and that's why you get the movement financially. But I do think that all we're doing is getting managed, and it doesn't matter if we're talking about COVID. It wasn't about telling me the truth. It was about managing my behavior. But in the markets, and it's funny you're bringing that up because it continually occurs to us. I mean, I think Jerome Powell's a decent man, and I think up in Canada, Tiff Macklin, the governor of the Bank of Canada. But I really do find myself over the last several months, especially with the inflation narrative saying, oh, it's transitory. And I'm going, how could you possibly think that? You know, in Canada, 27% jump in monetary supply in 1 year. In the States, 40% and more, you know, inflationary moves. And I'm going, you can't possibly think it's transitory. And of course, by December, they changed that. So I'm not even sure what to believe anymore.
I mean, you know, Mike, I was the first guy to attack the word transitory. Okay. When Jerome Powell first used that word, I'm like, he is either saying this to try and, again, maintain confidence, or he doesn't get it. And when you look back at Jerome Powell, who told us that he was a champion of Paul Volcker in the 70s, and the 70s style inflation would never happen on his watch, you almost kind of got to believe he believed that. And I think really even probably more so than that, he was putting his faith in the base effect, and that oil was not going to keep going up. And I said, the very beginning of 2021, the worst case scenario for the Fed could be, you're going to have a huge jump in the year-over-year dynamic in oil from 2021, from 2020, when remember, crude oil was minus $40 a barrel, all right? You know, the real low was $35 per se, but the futures market, the spot market, nobody wanted oil. So in that context, you had potentially a big base effect in 2021 that would have driven inflation up because of energy so high, and then that would play it off by really November, you know, December. The math was very simple. You could track this very easily by watching crude oil. Well, it didn't happen. I said in the very beginning, I go, the worst case scenario for the Fed would be that crude and gasoline just keep going up. What happens next? You're talking about this green energy thing. We've talked about this until we're, you know, blue in the face, you and I, Mike, about, you know, green energy. And, you know, this is an economic need, not a save the planet, because the science is so big, you can't save the planet. That's virtually impossible physically. So, you know, when you kind of look back at what this is all about, it was undoing of gasoline. And it's a dirty, expensive business. These companies have no money. You know, everyone sold their stocks. I mean, they were disinvested all over the place. So thinking that you're going to have enough gasoline going forward, it's going to be a constant problem because you can't put the EVs on the road fast enough. That all played into all of this driving gasoline higher continually, which meant by definition, inflation was never going to be transitory. And more than that, Mike, it's bigger. It's psychological in the sense that even if the year-over-year rate comes down, which it will, it's a mathematical certainty that the rate of inflation will fall, okay? But what's not going to happen, Mike, is prices are going to come back to where they were. They're never going to come down to those levels. This inflation is permanent because those price increases are going to stick.
This is such a key point you're making, because I just wait. A lot of times I feel that people reporting this in the media don't have the sophistication to see even simplistic relationships like that. So they'll sit there going, hey, oil's only up 1% this year. Oh, steady at 125 or something. Not getting that it's just what you're comparing it to. And for me as a consumer, and that's why I'm quite critical of the stats we get, because I say, I don't really care. How can you have core inflation? I'm talking from the consumer's point of view. Oh, we'll remove food and energy. Oh, really? That's helpful, because that's where I'm getting killed. You know, and I've seen so much of that. But your point, I just want to make sure people note that they'll be comparing next May and June with $120 oil. And if it only goes up 3%, that means we're whatever that is. We're at 130 by then.
Well, you know, Mike, if the Fed is telling us that they look, first of all, there's two things here. All right, let's look at where the, you know, kind of the peak Fed funds rate is implied in the future. It's around 375 now. I mean, there's talk about the Fed getting to 4%. Okay. But the Fed is looking for 2.6% inflation next year. All right. So if 2.6 inflation, if you use their R-star theory, which was hundreds of pages of white papers that they wrote about this, I read every dang page, right? On R-star and inflation anchoring and expectations, and this is a big deal. You would be talking about 50 basis points on top of the rate of inflation would be your neutral rate. Let's not talk normal. Let's not talk any of these other things than neutral. Okay. Does the Fed even want to be neutral? That's the next question, because with the economy, maybe not. Okay. And especially if inflation, you know, the year over year rate, let's keep in mind, does fall to 2.6, which is totally possible. Well, these are all, you know, really interesting questions. You might say by then they don't want to be, you know, neutral. They might want to be a little loose because the economy might need it by then. So to think that you're going to get to 375 when you have, you know, your expectation about a 2.6 inflation, they're out of touch with their own numbers. Then let's get to the fact that Powell, again, within his press conference, I can't believe how many times they say this, inflation expectations remain well anchored at 2%. What planet are you on, Jerome? I understand that you're trying to maintain confidence, but just look at the New York Fed survey. The one-year inflation rate hit a new high, 6.8%. Okay. The inflation expectations are wholly unanchored to the upside, and the Fed just doesn't get it. And I think really they missed the boat. They could have tightened 100%, you know, 100 basis points the first time, maybe even two meetings before they did, and they would be ahead of the curve now. Instead, they're way behind the curve. They're letting the markets puppeteer them instead of what they've done for the past 40 years, which is puppeteer the markets.
Well, now they find themselves raising rates into a declining economy. And I'm saying declining by the retail sales as an example, you know, and some, the housing, my goodness gracious. I'll talk to Ozzie Jurek about that in a few minutes. But I mean, we've been chronicling the massive increase in mortgage rates, you know, and the lack of renewals or refinancings and all of that stuff. So they're actually raising rates into a declining economy. And I mean, that's the dilemma they face.
And not only that, Mike, but I mean, let's talk, raising rates is one thing. Okay. Monetary conditions is a whole nother thing. All right. Because you have other things working in monetary conditions. The dollar is up 14% year over year. All right. Remember the old ERM when 15% was considered no, man, that's out of bounds. Right. The dollar is there. It's 14% year over year up. Okay. And so to me, that's number one. Number two, you're talking about the Fed has only just stopped adding liquidity at a 1.44 trillion annualized rate. Okay. Just last month. Okay, so when you're talking about this 1.44 trillion less liquidity in the bond market at a time when public borrowing is the highest it's ever been at 2 trillion, All right. I mean, this just doesn't compute. Monetary conditions continue to tighten. That's why the dollar has broken out to a 19-year high. And if you look at the long-term chart, the next resistance isn't till 121 in the dollar. It's right now at 105.5. I mean, this could still be so much more monetary conditions tightening than the Fed even anticipates just from a few rate hikes. But so I think that that's the danger to the stock market, and that's the danger to all asset prices. And we could talk about gold and Bitcoin all day long. I just did a special on gold, but I'm sure we'll get to that.
Well, and I'll come back to the stocks first here and translate it, because look at the reaction. We featured Bill Dudley from the New York Fed, you know, former head of the New York Fed, really sure. clearly saying, hey, guess what the Feds want to do? They want to bring your asset prices down. We featured yes. that as a warning, like, don't fight the Fed on the way down either. And I'm saying, look at the reaction already across asset classes. I mean, my goodness, I have trouble even comprehending what's coming next then if they just keep on this path.
Mike, I don't hear... And maybe, I don't watch the financial media anymore. I can't. It makes me ill. but the degree to which Powell used the word reset in his press conference when it came to U.S. housing. All right. He used the word reset. Okay. He avoided raising rates for so long, you couldn't even make a case that it was a politically motivated thing to keep his job. All right. And maybe he's bought into this whole narrative of liberalism and, kind of borderline socialism. To where it's like we need a reset. Now, I don't necessarily disagree with that, but I wouldn't look at it in those terms, all right? You need to try and let some air out of the bubble. The problem, Mike, is the bubble is 50 years in the making. To think you can let a little air out and reach a point where there's a reset and then plug the hole is moronic, and it's not going to happen that way.
Are you okay? So let's talk stocks in particular. You're still standing back of the overall market despite a 25, I'm picking a broad number, 25% decline.
Yes, right now, I mean, we've been short the entire time.
Yes, I know.
So, I mean, we started getting short some time ago. You know, there were periods where that was frustrating, you know, just like being long gold has been frustrating, but it's really paid off. Our biggest positions have been short the European bond markets. So that was after, of course, last year, our biggest position was short the U.S. 2-year, all right? So, you know, we've played this really, really well. The returns are through the roof, so we're very happy with that. From here, I think it is lower. But you could also see the NASDAQ hitting some retracement levels here. You could see the S&P, I think, has lower to go. But you're not that far away from some of the Fibonacci's based on the move from 2009. So that doesn't mean that we don't have further to go. And that could be much further because you're talking sub 3,000 S&P for sure, potentially something closer to 2,700, if not, a touch lower than that. That's a lot more of a haircut than we've even had already, relatively speaking. Then I think you get some kind of rally. And I think what may and you can make a case that the C wave or the ultimate low should be somewhere below the pandemic low, just from a pure long-term technical basis. And when you look at what have been priced in with the addition of $8 trillion, artificially floats this thing to an economic expectation that we knew was totally unrealistic. I mean, the XLY consumer discretionary was 180% above the 2019 high. That's totally, to price in a consumer that's 200% stronger than he was. The Fed's household survey of household confidence tells you households are much less confident even today than they were in 2019. And that still goes on. So when you look at all that, I think you're just staying away from equities. And I think from there, what you have is you have a rally that defines a top end. You make maybe a lower low that defines a bottom end, and you go sideways for a while.
Well, I just want people to be aware of that, as I say. They have to understand their risk. They're late. You warned every one of your subscribers. You warned every one of your clients about that. That's been one of our themes. Although I love how you were much stronger in your language. I'm being serious, stronger in your language. And I certainly could have been stronger, but it was certainly a clear warning also that all your risk is on the downside now. So I want to move.
Mike, let me just tell you, because I mean, I have like friends of mine that are, like one's a cop, right? And he doesn't make a hell of a lot of money. He's got a 401k. His wife is a nurse. She has a 401k. What do they do with their money? It's like I asked him one question because you just hit on it. This is really important because it just resonates with people because it's just sense. I'm asking him, when the stock market's at new highs, everyone's getting all excited and it might dip. And I say to him, look, are you looking for the next 10% of upside and willing to risk 40% of downside? Yeah. You have to have that incremental extra bit of money. You're going to be that greedy right now. Then let the whole thing slip away. And some people did, and most people didn't do anything. So I think that's key to mention, and I don't mean to interrupt what you were saying.
No, no, absolutely. I want to come to gold also. You wrote the Gold Mining Boot Camp. You know, you've been involved in that market. In and out, though, not always. You know, you're not a gold bug, but still, nope. Liked it sometimes, didn't like in others. I love, for example, I'm just going to go back for a second, digress, but I loved your recommendation at the 2020 World Outlook Conference. And you said, you know, I kind of like gold here. I kind of like it. But the way I'm going to play it is I'm going to find a junior producer and I'm going to buy their stock because they're cheap. And if gold does go up $200, $300, $400, it's going to go. But there's no time element on it like there would be an option or a futures trade. So I just want to relive that. I thought that I had never thought of that, and it was a fabulous thing. But so where are you at now with gold? I talked with Rob Levy. Sorry, I'll let you know. I talked with Rob Levy a little bit earlier in the show. And it's a point I've also made. People say, well, why hasn't gold performed? I said, well, ask them in Venezuela if it's performed, or Turkey, or Japan. Yeah. It's really performed.
Now, people, I get that all the time. You know, I mean, you know, gold's a piece of garbage, right? Because it's not doing anything, and this should be a safe haven, and, you know, so on and so on. You print the trillions of dollars, and now the stock market's going to collapse, and yields going up. Well, I mean, I would say two things. Gold is vulnerable. Number one, 1785. You take out 1785, you take the most recent low, the 2-year moving average, when the dollar is breaking out to a 20-year high. That's totally possible. It's in the cards. But the fact that it hasn't happened yet is huge. All right. And here's some examples of how gold actually looks phenomenal. You mentioned one of them. I mean, gold has held in with the dollar rallying 15% in the last year. Okay. When you can do the comparisons, all right, the dollar relative to gold is only up 3, all right, which means gold has held, you know, literally 12% of that value. Gold has matched in the rally of the dollar. That is big to me. It really is. All right. So what that means, of course, is what you just said. That means that gold has rallied in virtually every other currency on the planet. All right. So it has appreciated. It has done well, just not against the dollar, because the dollar has kind of become king. But gold wears the championship belt too at a lower level, because in that same vein, gold against the S&P 500 up 18% over the last 52 weeks. Moreover, gold against Bitcoin up 45% over the last 52 weeks. All right, Bitcoin has been exposed as a money for nothing vehicle as opposed to a safe haven or any kind of store of value. I mean, if you can't get free money for everybody from every central bank on the planet, you start to suffocate Bitcoin, which, by the way, Mike, I mean, you probably know this. I mean, they talk about a decentralized currency. It's the most centrally held asset on the planet. Number one, I believe in the metaverse. I believe in blockchain and Ethereum. But, you know, when it comes to Bitcoin, a little suspect.
So, you've given us some parameters already, but I'm just trying to reemphasize for people listening. Are you sort of depending on, obviously, everybody's got different circumstances. Maybe you already own 20% of your portfolios in gold already, so it's a different question for them. I'm saying you're not in the gold market with any force at all if an individual's there. Are you sort of just looking to buy on dips, with a 3-year time frame or a 5-year time frame?
Well, here's what I think is going to happen. It kind of has crystallized for me in the last couple of days. That's why I did a special on this today, which, of course, any of your listeners can feel free to email me and get. The way I look at it, there are certain signs out there in nuances of some of the fixed income markets that are something, for example, like the 2-year Fed fund swap against the 2-year treasury note, something I've been watching very closely. Has been a great metric that told us to get short the 2-year note way, way back in, long time ago, that are telling us that there is already some shift at subtle under the surface towards what's the next shift towards we address the economy by not tightening, or even what's the next easing process. That's the key to gold. Because if you remember the last time, I think it was on your show, you asked me kind of a similar question. I said, look, I think right now in the first phase, it's 2008, where gold goes down with everything else, but by less. And that's exactly what's happening. And gold's not even going down. But I could still see that. I could still see a crack, and then it holds. And look at silver. It's at a level where it kind of needs to hold. So maybe these things do hold, and it's phenomenal performance. When you get to the next thought process down the road, which is then again, you know, stock market's down even more, the economy, you know, maybe you start to see unemployment, you know, gains really slow, if not flip. Then you start thinking, when does the Fed take their foot off the brake? You'll have a natural decline in the year-over-year rate of inflation. And all of a sudden, you know, maybe 12 months from now, it's like, okay, well, maybe the Fed needs to, you know, loosen up a little bit here to get the, you know, get the labor market back to where it was. And all of a sudden, gold's taking off and you kind of miss the move. So you kind of want to be long. You want to own it. You'll have to understand there may be a little pain involved, but I think the key word, patience.
Yeah, it's interesting. You find yourself, you, Greg Weldon, weldononline.com, find themselves in a position where it's really interesting when you've been correct in the market. You know, and as you say, I mean, good God, shorting the European bond market. I don't even have to tell me how much money you made there. You know, Japan giving us a preview of what could be done there too this past week. But, and it's always how much further these trends are going to go. As I asked you about the stocks. Well, I think the predominance of evidence suggests you should, a normal person should be careful. They're not traders. I'm talking investors. Right. You know, as you say, well described in the gold market. I didn't get you on oil, so I better get very quickly back to oil for a second there. I mean, I can imagine a scenario, Greg, where not more than a scenario, a likely scenario where gold goes, oil goes much further in price than we're imagining right now.
That's my view. It's, you know, hey, near term could come down. I mean, it's funny. You talk about the financial media. One of the guys from CNBC was tweeting just a little while ago. Oh my God. You know, crude oil is at the lowest since May 16th as, you know, inflation coming down. It's just kind of like, dude, God, just looking for any little micro to use for a macro. I don't know about the near term. It's very difficult to call. I think there's downside in the near term. The stock market gets even uglier. That's going to cause a demand anxiety wave, which could bring down all the commodities, including gold and including oil. All right. They're technically vulnerable right here. Having said that, I think over the next 12 to 24 to even 36 months, you'll see gasoline over $10 a gallon. It's inevitable to me. You just don't have the setup capacity utilization wise in refineries in the U.S. You know, it's great to have all this crude and it's great that you want to do this. We, you know, go hat in hand to Saudi Arabia or now going to reopen the pipeline or drill and do it. You still need refineries to get the gasoline, man. And you haven't created a new one in the U.S. for 30 years. It's a dirty business. These companies expensive, dirty, I mean, expensive in terms of turnarounds and, you know, maintaining the refineries, man. These companies are debt ridden, cash poor, disinvested, and thinking that they're going to be able to maintain the kind of supply side dynamic that meets the demand side in the U.S. for gasoline is folly. And I think that you have much higher gasoline prices coming in the next year, 2 years, 3 years.
And the same situation in Europe, same situation in Canada. We only have 14 refineries that produce gasoline in the entire country. But it's funny, I don't want to digress too far, but I can't resist. Yeah. Your Secretary of Energy, Jan Grantham, she's on CNN this past week, and she's admitting that she wants the oil companies and the refineries to ramp up, get new refinery capacity. But she actually says in the interview, but we know in 5 to 10 years, we don't want your product. And I'm going, are you that removed from investment or
they
financial
are.
Reality that you don't understand? You've just told me not to invest because it'll take 10 years to get a new refinery. You're saying, well, by the time you get it open, we don't want it.
It's about the right soundbite that they want to have into the narrative right now. I mean, it has nothing to do with what they really mean, really want, or are ever going to really do. And I think you just hit a point, too. And now I already forgot it because that was such a good story. I can't remember what it was. Something kind of similar. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, the U.S. Department of Energy used to be a client of mine until Joe Biden took office. So, you know. There you go.
Wow. Well, as I say, I'm starting in my own head to sort of plan scenarios that take these trends further than we're imagining, whether it's interest rates. Yeah. But again, my interest rate scenario isn't the Fed. It's people just leaving the bond market. It's saying, that's
supply
not
demand.
Where I want to be. Yeah. And so I worry about
supply
that.
Demand. And I think the Fed has already lost control of the bond market. And I think there's a lot of evidence to support that point. So we'll see. I mean, they can bring rates down. That doesn't mean – look at where the 30-year is right now. I mean, it's about to take out the 2018-19 highs. You're talking about 340, 345. I mean, it's almost a major long-term breakout there again. So – You know, you could have a situation where bond yields keep rising no matter what the Fed does. And that would be, again, worst case scenario, something that would keep the stock market in check, keep it going sideways for the next 2 or 3 years maybe. And that's a worst case scenario, Mike, when you have all this debt that you need to service. You need growth. You need this upward track that is exponentially more parabolic. And that's what's missing now. And that's why a 50-year cycle is coming to an end. And that's the scariest thing of all.
Well, as I say, it's so noteworthy, and it's why it's great for Money Talks, by the way, Greg. Yeah. You know, people should be listening. Yeah. But it's also for Weldon Online, or Greg Weldon. Tell me a little bit about you guys obviously produce a ton of material. You know, one of the things we didn't get a chance today, we'll have to do it. It's my way of saying I'm going to get you on again real soon, and you'll have to say yes because it's live. You know, we're talking
now. I always say yes, Mike.
And you do, and we sincerely appreciate it. But there's so many global things to touch on. China, you're an expert on. And that's, of course, why, as I say, other analysts have a look at your work, because it's got a global perspective also and a dynamic to it. But tell us a little bit. Now, you also manage money down there. I say down there because
we do. Yeah, I'm a CTA, registered with the NFA Series 3, and we do manage money. We are taking in new money right now, which is not always the case. And I mean, our performance has been phenomenal.
I know.
I mean, I don't even really want to talk about it because it's something, you know, we do play it close to the vest. At the same time, we won't take just anyone's money. We do have $1 million minimum, which, you know, is going to scare some people off. But frankly, that's a number that comes from the math of the markets. I mean, you have a gold contract that can move $50 in a day. All right. That's $5,000 per contract. All right. If my single trade risk is half of 1%, I need $1 million to manage my per trade risk trading one single gold contract of gold. So, but our returns have been phenomenal. And, you know, we invite any accredited investors to, reach out to us, and we'll have a chat, you know, see if it's right for you.
But the other I want to talk about is some of the information services that you have, because you do daily updates. You know, anything big happens in the market, you also deliver the information there. Is it? I just want to make sure I've given it right, but it's Weldon, Weldon, WeldonOnline.com, and it gives you a little bit more about all that you do. You know, in your subscription services. Yeah.
Correct. We do Weldon Life, which is the one product we offer. It's all in. You get 100% of me. I don't leave anything out. It's as if, you know, you're in the money management program, only we're not managing your money. Of course, that means it's a different timeliness to it. I publish 3 to 4 times a week, depending. It's just me and Caitlin. You know, we run the whole show. So, you know, I publish as much as I can. And, you know, Mike, we pump out a mountain of material every week. And we cover everything, fixed income, foreign exchange, stock indexes around the world, all the commodities, energy, ags, ETFs, everything. And it's all like strategically based, but we cover the global macro scene, break down the Fed, had some really good pieces on the Fed this week, one of which I think I sent to you. Just being said, the Fed's lost credibility. I mean, it's just as simple. Some of the things they're saying now is ludicrous. So I appreciate that. WeldonOnline.com. Yeah.
And by the way, you can get a free trial there too. And I'd encourage people to go there because we both, and I hadn't talked to you before we've come on the air, you know, we didn't. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I'm fascinated to see the confirmation that I started with today in the show, by the way. I said, we got to get the era of cheap money, cheap energy, historic change, monetary crisis, sovereign debt crisis. Mm-hmm. You've never had a better reason to pay close attention in my lifetime. This is big time.
You know, one of my buddies actually said to me, he goes, man, you are made for these markets.
Yeah.
Like, you're right. I really am. That's a good
call. You are. And we, Greg, just know we do appreciate you finding time for us when we ask. Always. And I put you on every week, but I'm trying not to be abusive.
You do a great job, Mike, and I'm always happy to contribute and help you guys out. And, you know, kudos to you. You've been as prescient as I, and you really do. I'm in awe of you, and you do a fantastic job for your people.
Well, much appreciated. We'll talk again soon.
Okay, take care.
Time now for this week's shocking stat. Well, I think it's one that virtually all of us can relate to because I'm talking about the increase in the rise of gas prices. Personally, I've certainly noticed. I mean, my Philips gone for something like under $60 just 2 years ago. Well, now I went and thank goodness I don't drive a lot, but went to the gas station. It was over $120. And I think most of us would agree that's significant. But what about the impact on the economy as a whole? Well, so far we haven't seen what's called demand destruction from the rise in prices. In other words, people don't seem to have changed their driving habits. Well, maybe it's because maybe many of us consider that driving's essential. We're driving to work, or maybe we're picking up the kids after school, or grocery shopping, whatever it is. But that doesn't mean there isn't an impact elsewhere. Money spent at the gas pump is money that's not being spent somewhere else. So I thought I'd do an estimate of how much money we're actually talking about, which brings me to the shocking stat. Of course, this is just an estimate because, of course, gas prices do vary across the country, notably because there's a big differentiation in the level of taxation municipally and provincially. Also, it could be refinery costs, something like that. So StatsCan estimates that we buy about 39 to 40 billion liters of gas a year. Interesting to note, by the way, that in 2020, with the reduction in both business and individual use, of course, due to the pandemic, gas prices were as low as $1 a liter. And you compare that, again, on average, to something like $2.15. I know people in Vancouver say, what do you mean $2? Where do you get that? No, okay, $2.30. But as they say, it varies across the country. But in 2021, that dollar had risen to somewhere around $1.33. The first half of the year was lower than the second half of the year, especially the last 4 months. But that's sort of a reasonable average. So what's the ballpark about how much at these rates we'll be spending in 2022 compared to last year? Well, it looks like it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $32 billion more on gas. That's about $87 million a day. Then you have to add on, by the way, that's not the whole story because you've got higher diesel prices that are certainly impacting a heck of a lot of businesses and farms and some drivers. But I'm just talking gas right now, $32 billion. But it doesn't matter whether we're talking 25 or 35 or 40 billion in extra payments for our energy that way. That's a lot of money that's not going elsewhere in the economy. And the impact will be significant. I think in more discretionary areas like maybe we don't go out to the restaurant as much, or maybe we're not going to do some casual travel somewhere else, or we don't go to entertainment. But whatever it is, that's a big chunk of change. But the other way may happen, of course, the other consequence may be that people will run up their credit card debt and not change anything for now in order to maintain that spending. But my point, with this much extra money going to gas, the impact's going to be felt somewhere. I said right off the top that, my goodness gracious, there is so much to talk about here. So many major themes that are consistent with what we've been talking about on Money Talks for a couple of years. And one of them comes into the real estate market. That's why I was happy to get Ozzie Jurek back on with me. I sent him a couple of notes this week saying, oh my goodness. But oh my goodness, Ozzie, about the rate of change on the mortgage market, the mortgage, you know, the interest itself, not so much the bank rate, which of course gets all the attention, it's the actual rate of change in the mortgage market rates.
Yeah, particularly, I guess people don't realize that the long-term mortgage rates are always tied to the bond rate, and the bonds have gone absolutely bananas this week. And so here in the United States in January, we're just below 3%. And this week, we were astounded last week when it hit 5.3%. 1 week later, it's 6.39%. And so these are huge increases which will have an impact.
Well, I feel it's sort of like shock therapy. It's like people just get shocked and they're going to come back to the market. I'm not saying the real estate market's dead by any means, but in the shorter term, yeah, I think it's shock therapy that people just sort of back off and there's no room to adjust to the change.
The famous term shock and awe, right?
Yes.
I mean, everybody was shocked. And today the stock market is, or rather, I guess, the stock markets of the world are in shock. Everything is in shock. Now, the interesting thing is BMO made a comparison about the late 80s to today, and they felt that the income needed to carry a mortgage, which was a record then, well, we're getting close to a similar record if you compared inflation-adjusted incomes this February to the 80s. And when you take a look at the 80s, Mike, and we talk about high rates, my goodness, the federal funds rate was 20% in 1980, 21% in June 81. The mortgages in the United States reached 16.6%. And hey, Canada was not far behind because our five-year term was over 15% for 2 years. Now, that's high interest rates.
But there's a point there, is that, again, markets will adjust. I still see immigration coming into this country. What will adjust is probably price, but not demand, if you follow my point, is that people still want their housing. And, you know, with rising mortgage rates, the affordability goes down. So presto, if I want to sell, I'll just lower the price of my house and that I'm putting up, I'm listing, but I still see that activity. There's nothing that's happened that will say to people, I don't want a home in Canada any longer. I've had that dream, but I'm going to let it go. So I just see this more as a price adjustment on the shorter term.
Well, yes, and certainly I'm totally on side. I believe that inflation is the most, we have the most unreported inflation of all times, and I've been saying it for 20 years, and that will continue. But most importantly, also, we have to have the word of timing. When I wrote my book, Forget About Location, the point I was trying to make was that timing is just as important. And the timing now is sort of kind of interesting, because if you listen to CBC's Knowlton Nash, who told the viewers of The National, on August 18, 1982, he says, a year ago, housing prices were sky high. It cost so much to buy a house in Vancouver that most people simply couldn't afford it. That sounds familiar, right? But the key was, it was $235,000 then. But he did say that it now, a year later, it had value fallen by $60,000. So nothing stays the same.
Well, come on, Ozzy. You and I have known each other a long, long time. I kind of remember a period at that same time when you took that advice and you left the country. So tell me, just give us the 1 minute on that one.
Well, I sort of shamefacedly have to admit that I followed Harry Brown, he of How to Profit from a Monetary Crisis, who said we're going to be in a depression or we're going to be around the inflation. Well, I thought we'll have one more happy year in Mexico, took my kids out of school, and that's what we did. Okay, I've always been a little eccentric. But when I was down there, I had tried to sell my house for $125 in Coquitlam and couldn't give it away. Within 6 months, my manager that replaced me kept calling me and saying, Ozzy, I can get you $150. Ozzy, I can get you $170. Finally, when he told me $200, I said, you're nuts. So I went back to Coquitlam, took a good hard look around, and half the houses, Mike, were selling quick, and the other half was sitting there for a month. And I said, what can you get me today? He said, $220. I said, no, make it $195. And I sold, and that was the highest price achieved in that marketplace for a couple of years.
That actually, though, I want to go further with that message. I'm talking now to people who do want to sell their house for whatever reasons they've got. They want to, but your idea about pricing is very important. It reminds me of Jim Dines used to talk about that with stocks. You know, if it ever gets back to $10, I'm selling, but it never does. Okay, $9, I'm selling. Well, it never quite got there. $8. And by the time they're, it's $2 by the time they sell. But the problem is they're sort of chasing the market down, if that makes any sense.
Well, certainly on the seller side, so often I remember a famous West Van realtor, even in 2008, says, Ozzy, you have the house listed at $2,100,000. I told the owner, he has to come down to $1,900,000. And a month later, he came down to $1,900,000, but then he had to go down to $1,700,000. You always follow the market down. But the most important thing to me is not to be scared. If you want to buy a house for yourself and your family and live somewhere, still the best place to do is buy some a house that is good for your family. If you want to make a quick buck, stay the hell out.
Well, the other thing, just before we go, a couple things. One is I don't see the same kind of impact on rents, because again, that's a shortage problem. And there's nothing about raising interest rates that changes that in any way. So we're still going to have a high demand in the rental side of market, I suspect.
Yeah, and the rates, as we pointed out a couple of weeks ago, rents are up almost over 20% across the board in Canada, and particularly Toronto and Vancouver. And it's clearly we still are undersupplied. And no matter what we do, we don't have enough housing for the number of people that are coming.
And don't let me put words in your mouth, but just to finish here, the other thing that's going on is more back to what your line that we're in the most underreported inflation. Well, we have reported the asset price increases. We've made it very clear on Money Talks. When the Federal Reserve said we want asset prices down, they were going to be successful. But beyond that shorter term stuff, you're still talking about the devaluation of the purchasing power of currencies. You literally just cannot print up this kind of money and have it worth the same in terms of buying power. So that's why that's one of my increased population, increased newcomers coming to the country, and the devaluation are some of the reasons that I'm still long-term bullish on real estate in Canada or certain centers in Canada.
Absolutely. Actually, long-term on all true blue hard assets. I mean, I wouldn't pay $400 million for a painting, but it is because that money is available or was available at very cheap rates.
Why didn't
I think house prices?
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, why didn't you tell me that about the painting before I went to the auction last week? I had some spare cash, but I'm with you. Collectibles will be further down the line.
But in 5 years' time, you'll see that house prices are higher again. And in fact, I had predicted in 1998 that house prices in Vancouver could easily be $5 million. So, but not this year. Yeah. And so timing is very important. Look carefully where you want to buy. Canadian Real Estate Association said this week that the average house price in Canada went from $816,000 in February to $711,000. So we've seen a little crack in the dam on prices. So you don't have to rush. Make sure you got subjects in there. Make sure you get your mortgage approved as soon as possible. But don't be too scared.
Good stuff, Ozzy, as usual. And people can get more on ozbuzz.ca. You know, every Saturday, it's not just a day off for some people. It's the day Ozzy posts the latest edition of OzBuzz. So it's ozbuzz.ca. Thank you, Ozzy.
Thanks, Mike. And do remember that whatever you do, always give 100%. Unless, of course, you're donating blood.
I'll keep that in mind, as well as your advice about don't purchase that picture for, $400 million. Ozzy Jurek, ozbuzz.ca.
I'm sort of giggling. I'm sort of laughing at myself every week now because I bring Victor on and I say, you're my cleanup hitter. Why? Because there's so much happened. We can't touch on it all during the show. Well, Vic, boy, I'm not sure if to me, this felt like one of the most significant weeks, as I've been alluding to, you know, throughout the show that we've had in a while. And we've had nothing but significant weeks.
Yeah, this week was especially significant. The central banks were running the show. I mean, it seemed virtually every central bank in the world got into the act. Certainly the Fed on Wednesday cranked up rates by 0.75 points. The Swiss National Bank the next day, a total surprise, raised rates by 0.5 points, brought their rates all the way up to -0.25%. The Bank of Japan decided to stick with their easy program. The Bank of England raised rates by 0.25. Who else was in there? Oh, yeah, the European Central Banks indicated that, yeah, they might be a little tougher next month when they finally get their act together. And we're expecting the Bank of Canada in a couple of weeks here to bump rates by about 0.75%. So, yeah, it was central banks were dominating. From my perspective, the price action was just really, really choppy. I mean, a couple of times here, it seemed we had like the Dow swing 1,000 points in a couple of hours. So, you know, sometimes for traders, that's great news. But I think it's kind of showing the underlying emotion, at the very least, that participants have in the market right now.
Well, one of the things I posted, and you know, that's a plug for Money Talks tweets and on Michael Campbell's Money Talks Facebook, but I posted it and I said, and I started the show with this. I think it's essential for people to understand the era of cheap money is over and the era of cheap energy is over. And that's a hell of a combination, you know, to get both happening at the same time. And what you've just alluded to, look around the world, the era of cheap money is over. And what's sort of kind of interesting, it looks like the Federal Reserve certainly is comfortable crashing asset values. You know, that wealth effect that we talked about a couple of months ago or even 3-4 months ago when the former head of the New York Federal Reserve, Dudley, warned that this is exactly what the Fed were going to do. You know, and it's the old don't fight the Fed on the downside either. But yeah, I think what you've just said is confirmed that look around the world, the era of cheap money is over.
Well, that era goes back 40 years, you know. We had Volcker raise rates to break the back of inflation. That happened in the 1970s. So for 40 years, we've had interest rates trend lower. And gee whiz, you know, asset prices trended higher, whether you're talking stock markets, real estate markets, whatever. Cheaper money does make other things, prices rise. Anyway, here we are. The S&P is down about 24% from all-time highs. The Dow's down a little better than 20%. Those markets are back to where they were just after Joe Biden was elected. And the really emotional kicker was when Pfizer announced they had come up with the miracle vaccine. So we're back to those levels now. We've given up the gains from the highs. The Toronto market is not down as much. I think maybe credit commodities, broadly speaking, we're down about 15% from the highs in the commodity market. But I think the currency markets, we had the U.S. dollar touch a new 20-year high this week. The Canadian dollar here was 80 cents 2 weeks ago. It's come off about 3 cents in that period of time. The big question here really is, are the central banks going to tighten into a recession? They were late to get going in terms of fighting inflation. You know, they may be late to back off a bit. Certainly the market is worried that that's exactly what they're going to do. They're going to just, you know, put the pedal to the metal, as it were, the brake pedal. And that's going to, as I wrote in my notes last week, if the Fed is doing that, then something, if not a lot of things, are going to break.
And it will take that break, I think, for the shift in policy. And of course, that's what everybody's guessing at. And 1 week, the market seems to say, oh no, they'll never go through with it. You know, they'll stop in September. Then another week, they come along and say, oh boy, they're serious. They're going to keep going. And I think people have to understand that's the debate going on within the market. But I look at things like, you go back to this level of inflation, 1981. The federal funds rate was 13%, not 1% or 1.5 or 2, you know, 13%. So, excuse me, that's part of that bigger context. So this is just an incredible time that I also put my overlay on it, Vic, because we've got a sovereign debt crisis that's sort of rippling underneath the surface. If everybody followed the emerging markets, they know it's not on underneath the surface at this point, but it started to move, as I alluded to earlier in the show, into Greece, into Italy, into Spain, you know, with the ECB, European Central Bank, so worried about it, they had an emergency meeting about what's going on with their interest rates. I mean, I just sit there going, this is a crazy time.
Well, it really really depends on your time frame here. You know, I just alluded to 40 years ago, we had interest rates so high, and then they declined for a great period of time. And in a 40-year span, you know, we barely come off the top here in terms of the stock market being down 25% from where it was at the beginning of the year. What I think here with my short-term trading is that the market is pricing in the Fed's going to break some stuff. You know, I mean, some stuff's already broken. You know, you referenced Peloton so many times, you know, some of those things. Maybe the people that paid $1 million for a baseball card 6 months ago are having trouble finding a bid right now. That's what I mean by things are going to break.
Well, and don't set me up like that. You started with a baseball card. How about the people owning the NFT monkeys or whatever they were, the apes? Right. You know, some of those prices, but we talked about it. And that's why I never got involved with it personally. It's because I thought those prices were unjustifiable. They were insane. I've always had and I might have been, by the way, I could have made money in cryptos, but I didn't. Because I couldn't get involved with a parabolic trade. I just don't have that in my nature, you know. And I looked at the losses in the crypto space at $2 trillion now. I mean, it's just another one. I can't even imagine what the losses in the NFT side of things are. And that's the environment we're operating in. But I think the key here is, what are we going to do going forward? I guess I'm looking for a break in the US dollar of significance. That may signal a shift, but definitely, which side's going to win out? The central bank's going to keep going till they break a lot more stuff, or they'll back off before they break a lot more stuff?
I listened to David Rosenberg a couple of days ago. He thinks we're already in a recession. And when I use the word we, I mean the American economy. Canada seems a little stronger than that. But of course, we'll follow suit very quickly because we're tied at the hip economically. Again, as a short-term trader, I bought the bond market this week. And I know you and I, on a longer term perspective, see interest rates going higher. But one of the things I'm concerned about here is that for the past 10 years or so, people have got into what they call passive investing. And the thinking there is, instead of trying to pick a stock or time the market, you just buy the whole market, you know, and the Wall Street's created products so you can do that. And you just keep buying it forever. And, you know, you look at the 100-year history and it goes up and it has corrections. I'm wondering what it will take for those people to start to change their mind. And what I've been writing in my blog for months now is that I think it would take the market being down at least 6 months and probably being down more than 30% or so before those people start phoning up their advisor and saying, you know, I'm not so sure this is a good idea. Those people have not begun to sell yet.
Because they, I think one of the reasons they haven't noticed that they could move into a fixed income instrument, you know, forget my real view on bonds, but a fixed income and get 5 or 6% right now. They don't know, you know, when bonds were, you know, giving you 1%, it wasn't much competition for equity money that was going up at double digit rates. Well, now that's changed. You know, I'm saying watching my investments go down in the stock market. Oh, but you know, I don't mind. We were talking to Justin Smith earlier, you know, mortgage rates or mortgage quality mortgage backed securities at 7%. Well, that's going to start providing some competition. So I think that's one other factor. And I'll throw one more at you, Vic, that you're obviously well aware of. But I also see some liquidation going on here. When you lose this much money, what, $30 trillion in equities, $2 trillion in cryptos, some people are going to have financial problems and they're going to be forced to sell. You know, not just on a margin call, just in the wherewithal. I think we're going to start seeing people forced to leave their houses. They can't afford 500 or 600 or 700 more in mortgage payments. And some people, a small percentage, are going to start feeling that. I think that's going to be another factor involved here.
Well, certainly, again, that's what I would call things are going to break. One of the justifications for buying stocks, regardless of the price, was called TINA. There is no Yes. alternative. And what you're just saying right now is there are alternatives. And I think folks with a longer term time frame, people aren't that aren't trying to just get rich quick, realize and say, well, you know, okay, you can buy corporate bonds here with a 5% yield. They got good coverage. You know, you're looking at value more than, you know, trying to chase the latest horse out of the gate.
Well, of course, people are now going to say, I just listened to the two good humor men, you know, the two cheerful guys, but it's important. And that's why I encourage people to go to victoradair.ca, victoradair.ca, A-D-A-I-R, because these are the kind of markets, as Vic and I were both alluding to, Greg Weldon's alluding to, man, you got to watch them on a momentary basis. Good place to do it is victoradair.ca. So, Victor, I'll be looking for your bids on the Special Olympics auction. And I hope you have a terrific week.
I'll be hitting them, Mike. I'll be hitting them.
There you go. You'll be outbidding me. There you go. You hear it here, folks. Victor Adair will do it. VictorAdair.ca. Thanks, Vic.
Thanks, Mike.
Time now for this week's Goofy Award. And it's brief and easy to understand. Golf fans are going to recognize there's been a huge issue in professional golf, especially it reached a crescendo this week with the inaugural Saudi Golf Tour. It's called the LIV Tour. It's backed by $2 billion from Saudi Arabia's Sovereign Wealth Fund. Well, it had its first event a week ago. That's a lot of money. And they've used it to try and attract some of the big names from the PGA Tour, who, not surprisingly, is not happy about this. So far, they've been successful in getting a commitment, rumored to be as much as $200 million from Phil Mickelson. Commitment from Dustin Johnson, that rumor is about $150 million. They've also attracted Bryson DeChambeau, $100 million. I mean, that's huge money that obviously can't get matched. They're all, and by the way, DeChambeau hasn't played yet. He's playing in the next event. But this goofy isn't about whether individuals who are choosing to leave the PGA Tour should be doing it. Leave that aside. But not surprisingly, there's been a universal condemnation of the new Saudi Tour from the PGA Tour itself, who has now indefinitely suspended any of the PGA players who've signed on to the Saudi Tour, something like 17, 18 players. But this is all happening under the intense media spotlight. Why? Because this week's the U.S. Open. So all the top named players are there, including Nicholson and Johnson and DeChambeau. Well, of course, the press conferences were quite something. But that's where the focus has been. It's actually taken away some of the focus from the major tour event, the major, the U.S. Open. But that's enough background. But I want to get to the goofy now. Phil Mickelson's been critical of the PGA Tour on, well, somewhat of a regular basis in the past. And perhaps it's not surprisingly he took the opportunity to jump to the Saudi Tour, especially with that kind of money involved. But this is what I found incredible. He did a press conference on Monday. The Golf Channel and one of the other major networks featured, well, he got featured on every major network, but that snippets from that. But then they feature all these panels and experts come on. Of course, all of them were critical of Mickelson's decision to play in the Saudi Tour. But what they never said was that every single one of the commentators works either directly or with the blessings of the PGA Tour itself. I mean, it was a laughable omission. Of course, they're all going to be critical of Mickelson. But on a more serious side note to the goofy. Those critical of the PGA Tour players' defection fell back on a very sincere criticism of the families who lost loved ones in the 9/11 attacks. They're outraged that these players are ignoring the role Saudi Arabia played, as well as the human rights abuses in that country. They call it sports washing, an effort to use well-known golf professionals to gloss over the human rights record and the devastation felt by families of 9/11 victims. And I'm completely on board with that criticism. But here's the goofy part. It's incredibly selective. The same analysts and tour officials who are outraged by taking Saudi Arabian money, they don't display any such concern when it comes to China and the many U.S. corporations that deal directly with the Communist Party, including Apple, Amazon, Google, Microsoft, Facebook, Calvin Klein, and Nike. They've actually been accused even of using goods in their supply chain with links to human rights abuse. Not a word about the NBA, though, or well-known players whose shoe and apparel deals are directly linked with forced labor, let alone the blatant human rights abuses of the Chinese government. So sorry, it's a little bit too convenient to just cherry-pick these PGA players in the Saudi tour. As I say, the criticism I agree with, but I'd extend it well past them. And as I've said on many times in this show, I believe that Western businesses that are choosing to turn a blind eye, for example, to the Communist Party of China's human rights abuses, are really going to regret it. And we've already seen it in Russia. This is an issue in the Saudi tour. You know, as a side note, this past week, Xi Jinping signed a new set of articles in China that fundamentally give the government the right to confiscate the assets of Western companies if China decides that whatever those Western companies are doing is against the interests of China. You know what? I'm sure we're going to get a preview of that if China gets more aggressive with Taiwan and there's some sort of Western opposition and pushback. But the point is, a little too selective for me to just single out the Saudi golf tour and ignoring all that's happening in other parts of the world, corporate outings in other parts of the world, especially when you're talking about communist China. Hey, that's all the time we have. I got to remind you again, hey, Special Olympics auction. There's so many great items to have that you can just tune into. And it only runs for a couple of days. I mean, it's over on Tuesday, June 21st. I forget the time. It's in the evening, though. So again, I really hope you go. You just have to go to www.sobcclassic. So there's two C's here. sobcclassic.com. And my point is this, as I said earlier, if you're planning to go out for dinner, hey, why not do it through the site? If you're planning on vacation, oh my goodness, there's some fantastic vacations, including my favorite. I mean, it's a big time one. You're going down to Mexico, unlimited golfing there. And the list is just a huge one. And as I say, you've got to look at it. It's like a golfer's paradise. It's a two-bedroom in the Glen Lux Villa in Nuevo Vallarta and 16 rounds of golf included. Well, I'm going to be bidding on that one. And the reason is, hey, I'm going to try and go on vacation this year. COVID's going to be over. I can do it. Well, why not do it for Special Olympics? And as I say, there's so many other things, big and small. As I say, if you want wine, why not go on the auction site? I could go on forever. Why? Because I'm a big supporter of Special Olympics. And I know members of Money Talks audience have certainly joined us in that. So just go to www.sobcclassic.com. sobcclassic.com. That's all the time we have. I'll give you the results of those auctions, but in the meantime, have a terrific week.
This is the Money Talks podcast with Michael Campbell, available at mikesmoneytalks.ca or through your favorite podcast subscription service. Join us on Facebook at Michael Campbell's Money Talks and on Twitter at Money Talks Tweet.